Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
So hey, my name is Janet Simpson, and this song is called Safe Distance.
Janet, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me this evening.
Hey, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad to get to talk to you.
Yeah, so November, you got the album finished up, Safe Distance.
That's right.
Big prediction for 2020.
Yeah, so then I decided to start a pandemic to help support the record.
Yeah. Right. We'll work our way to that. I just wanted to start with, where are you originally from, and tell me about growing up.
So I'm from Georgia, and I was born in Atlanta and grew up, spent my childhood in Rome, Georgia, which is in the northwest corner of Georgia. And, you know, it's kind of a small Appalachian foothills town. Mm-hmm. There are colleges there, so it kind of has the both sides of the South. It has, you know, these really beautiful liberal arts schools, and so there were a lot of great access to arts and, you know, good education there. But there was also, it's also the Deep South, you know, yeah. And so it had all of the complications of that.
Sure. Well, tell me a little bit about music. Was it mom and dad records playing in the home, or what really caught your ear when it came to music?
Yeah, I would say that some of my earliest memories, and I know they say that you're not supposed to be able to remember really anything from your childhood before you're 5 years old, but I have memories going way back. My parents had a Mustang with an 8-track uh-huh. player in it, and I can remember sitting in the back seat listening to Dionne Warwick when we were driving down the road, and the Doobie Brothers and Jackson Browne, and music was a big, big part of my life. My parents both are big music fans, mm-hmm. had great record collections, and so it was always in the backdrop, and, you know, they said that I started making up songs as soon as I started talking. So I was singing about, I was narrating the world around me,
oh, yeah.
Making up songs about it. So they were really great. We did not have a lot of money, but they were really interested in my interest in music and wanted to support that. And so they, you know, put a lien on their car and bought a upright piano for the house and enrolled me in piano lessons at, you know, the community school at Shorter College. And so I started studying piano classically at
six. How old
were
you? Oh, at six. Yeah. Okay. You know, I hear, like, stories of people starting that early. Like, one of my best friends, he's got a 4-year-old girl, and it was the most precious thing right when they got her little karaoke machine. You didn't have to tell her what to do with that microphone
yeah.
while she was singing.
Yeah, it's natural.
And, you know, his wife, her parents made her take piano lessons, which during that whole time she hated, but now she's glad she went through it.
Right.
And so they're getting ready to start her at the age of 4 on violin. And, like, I'm always curious about that, like, from kid to kid it varies. Like, if you have these early vivid memories of already singing and making things up, it's there.
Right.
But what about those who are, you know, maybe not necessarily into it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's like anything. I mean, some kids are really going to love math, and they're yeah. going to be drawn to it, and it's going to be a part of almost every child's education, you know, and yeah. some of us, like me, are going to, like, hate math class with their soul,
yeah.
you
know? Right.
So, but I'm glad I had math class,
yeah.
you know, and I'm glad that I have those skills that helps you to think critically and, you know, problem solve, so. But yeah, it's funny, like, I have a lot of friends who grew up in hating piano lessons and dreading it, and I felt like, my piano teacher that I had in high school was this amazing lady named Marianne Knight, and she was Italian and from New York, and very funny sense of humor, and made me feel very at ease as a kid, as an awkward kid,
mm-hmm.
with her sense of humor, and but also she gave me a lot of credit for being a person. I think at that age it's real easy to, like, I started studying with her when I was in junior high, and I think when you're 11 or 12, middle school age, you know, you're still a child very much, and the world, most adults treat you like you don't know anything,
uh-huh.
but she tapped into that I did know stuff, you know, that I did actually have an experience of the world, an emotional interpretation of the world, and she introduced me to composers like Chopin and Mozart, and taught me how I could express those emotions through playing this music.
Mm-hmm.
And she was supportive of my songwriting. I started writing songs when I was in fifth or sixth grade, like really writing songs.
Mm-hmm.
And she was supportive of that. We never did that in the studio, but, you know, she was aware when I was 13, 14, I started playing in bands, you know, rock bands, and she was aware that that was a part of my life, and she supported that creativity, even though she was like, but we're not going to do that here. In here, you're going to learn Brahms and Debussy. You can do that out there.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, but she did, it does exist.
Right, yeah. And she was like, I get it, but you can use this to help you with that.
So
and
are we still in Rome, Georgia at this
point?
Yeah,
it's still in Rome. Yeah.
So what about up to high school? Would you continue with classical training?
I did, all the way through high school, and actually in college I was a piano pedagogy major.
Is that Montevallo?
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you and Sarah met?
Yes, that's right, yeah. So we were both in the music program there together.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. She told me a cool little story about, you know, days gone by, y'all would both be spokespersons for women in country music, right?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Which was, I felt... really surprised to be asked to do that. Sarah made perfect sense, and I was like, let me bring Sarah along, because she grew up in this stuff, and I didn't, you know?
Yeah.
But it was really fun. We got to do that at the Alice Stevens Center, and it was a good thing to get to do together.
Yeah, and just to plug that for listeners, it's Sarah Lee Langford. She has a phenomenal record out called Two Hearted Rounder that you should check out.
Absolutely.
She was recently on the show. But just... Was there anything, any other interest from middle school to high school that was even pulling you away from music, or were you just totally bought in?
You know, I probably anything that involved creativity, creative writing, poetry, you know, I was a very romantic child, you know, I still am. And so anything that was... involved with romanticism, I was into it. I was a ballet dancer, and I probably would have pursued that more heavily, but music just won out. It was natural, and you know, dancing involves music, and theater involves music. So I did theater for a little while, but I discovered pretty early on that I didn't like the theater world. I didn't like the culture of the backstage and theaters. It was really competitive and
cutthroat,
and I was too sensitive.
Yeah. And so when it came down to time of picking colleges, would this be the first time that you would be leaving Rome? Or?
Well, it's funny because, you know, I was just talking about theater. I got out of high school early. I graduated when I was 17, and my parents were still in Rome, and my mom had gone to Shorter College, and both of my aunts had gone to Shorter College, and so the expectation was I was going to Shorter College.
Uh-huh.
Now, none of the women that went to this college in my family graduated from this college. They just all started
there.
So I followed in their footsteps. I went for
a year and a
half.
Was that liberal arts, though?
What's that?
Was it liberal arts there?
It is.
Okay.
But I would compare it to Samford. It's a private Baptist liberal arts school.
Okay.
And it was where I had grown up in their conservatory studying music. And so for that reason, you know, it felt like, okay, I was a little too young to fully leave the nest, you know, and leave my parents' home at 17. I was an immature 17, I would even say. But I also I chose musical theater as my major because I was like, well, I sing, I dance, I play piano, I can do all this stuff. So I'll do this and I'll figure it out later. And that's when I really learned, like, I was not cut out for it.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber in my spare time. I was listening to rock music, you know? That was where my soul was. And
who were some of those guys at the time?
At the time?
Yeah, what were those influences?
Oh, so this was the mid-90s, and I probably, like, PJ Harvey, the Pixies, Throwing Muses, the Smiths, and then, like, a little later on, I started just started playing with music, like, oh, there's all these great, like, schmaltzy 70s singers. I started to, like, not try to listen to the cool music, you know, mm-hmm. that I had learned about in high school, but to kind of branch out and learn more. And a lot of the kids in the program were also, like, from affluent families in the Atlanta area. And so I also just couldn't find my place in that world.
Yeah.
And so I dropped out. I started going to a community college for a little while, studying art history and just the things I was sort of naturally drawn to or hadn't even studied before, hadn't contemplated before. And then I just dropped out of school altogether for a few years. And that's when I decided to, I had to leave Rome. By this time I was 18 or 19. Maybe I was just about to turn 19. And I needed to get away from my parents, you know, because it was time. And I needed to get out of the small town. It was time. So I moved to Atlanta and decided I'm going to try to just do music and see if I can make it.
Now, at that time, what did that look like? When did the guitar, were you playing guitar at this time? And
yeah, I had picked guitar up being a summer camp counselor where everybody played guitar.
Oh, yeah, and campfires,
so,
right?
Right, exactly. So learning Bob Dylan songs and, you know, John Denver, you know, the stuff you would sing around the campfire.
Oh, yeah.
And like you could hide in the crowd because everybody was playing guitar. So you, I would just watch everybody's hands and do what they were doing, you know, and I picked it up pretty quickly enough that I could use it as a tool to write songs on, by that point. And so when I moved to Atlanta, you know, I had been playing in bars since I was 14, in bands. And acoustic alone, solo, since I was, you know, 18. And I really felt I was ready to try the big city, you know, and see what that was like and go and play there.
So when you were playing there, were you playing originals and covers or?
Just originals. I had a really strong bent towards only doing originals. And if I did a cover, it was going to be something totally out of left field and unexpected, you know.
Yeah.
But I really focused on songwriting, and so that was really the beginning where I really threw myself into the deep end of the pool.
Yeah. And so, what did that look like at first, Atlanta? Was it coming up and okay, let's put a band together, or it was just you?
Just me. I did the hard work of putting myself into every open mic situation I could find, which open mics were so hard to get into. Like, I didn't know.
It's very cliquish.
How hard? Well, just like everybody had already signed up by the time you got there, you know? It was just like there wasn't any room. So you would have to, like, hang out, get to know the people that worked at the club, and beg them get you a spot on the list so that you could play. And it was really hard. It was really lonely. I didn't know anybody there. And it was scary, you know, for a little while.
Of course, leaving little Rome to go to big Atlanta, right?
Yeah, you know. And then I ended up meeting other women my age, you know, who were like in their late teens, early 20s, who were trying to do the same thing, who had moved to Atlanta to do the exact same thing. And I found this incredible community. And then this really great thing happened, and my best friend, who I hadn't been best friends with until this time, but she appeared out of nowhere. And she was somebody I'd known since fourth grade. We actually wrote a song together when we were at marine biology camp when we were in sixth grade. And but I didn't really know that she had really started playing and singing and trying to do it. And we just happened to run into each other, and she's like, I have so much to tell you. I've been touring with my uncle and playing music, and I know you've been playing music too, so we need to talk. And
right.
So we got together. We ended up moving in together, you know. She would let me tag along and play shows with her, because what had happened with her life is she had gotten very established.
She had notoriety.
She did, you know, for us at that age, it seemed like big time, you know,
and so, everything, yeah.
Right. So I got to play with her and get a lot of really interesting opportunities. And I learned a lot of really fun and also difficult lessons, you know, about what it was, what you really had to do to professionally gig. And then I started working at a record label.
Oh yeah.
So I started working at Ichabod Records, which was a small independent label whose focus was R&B and soul when they first started. By the time I started working with them, they had expanded. They really did a ton of rap and hip hop. Mm-hmm. They had absorbed other labels like Sky Records. So they had artists like Guadalcanal Diaries uh-huh. and Love Tractor in their catalog, Mo Tucker. But then on the other side, they still had kind of this like old South R&B like Theotis Ely and Francine. And then they had, you know, Miami bass stuff like DJ Smurf, and they had Lil yeah. John and the East Side Boys. Right. And so like it was a label with its, that was spread a little thin, uh-huh. you know, and was trying to survive when the whole industry was changing. So Napster happened that year.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was just a big sea change coming. So that was just another really incredible opportunity for me to learn about music business.
Did the music that was coming out of that record label, did that have any kind of impact or influence on the way that you were inspired to write your own music?
I think it gave me exposure to a lot of music I had never been exposed to mm-hmm. before. Particularly, I think about Francine Reed and Theotis Ely. These were artists that were really deeply established here in the South, but I was not going to cross paths with, right. you know, in my very small world that I had been circulating in. And so I think in that regard, it did impact me, because I'm getting to hear real blues, you know, dirty blues, you know, mm-hmm. like going to clubs and watching how they manipulated crowds, and that was totally different than the indie sort of sensibilities I was exposed to, or the female acoustic world that I was exposed to yeah. before that. So
kind of saw some of the ugliness of it all.
I saw some of the ugliness of the industry in particular. Like I think that it made me run screaming from the idea of getting a record deal. You know, yeah. it seemed really dangerous. It seemed really like you could be easily manipulated before you knew what was happening.
Yeah.
And I was seeing that with artists who were being groomed for the label. They would come in one way, and then their image would change, and their packaging would change, and then all of a sudden their songs would change. And I thought, wow, it's just really easy for it to get out of hand and you not feel like yourself anymore.
Sure, yeah. So what happened to make you want to leave Atlanta?
So it was really clear that the label was going to dissolve soon. Mm-hmm. They had laid off half the staff, and I was kind of in crisis, and I was 21 by this point. And I felt like part of me wanted to finish school, for one thing. And I had that need to have a different experience. Like, okay, I've gone to Atlanta and done the Atlanta thing, and it's really been eye-opening and good for me. But now I need to go somewhere really small and really different. And my friend and I were having lunch one day, and he said, you know, if you're thinking about school, you should consider Montevallo. I was like, Montevallo? Isn't that where Thomas Jefferson lived? You know, like, I was yeah. like, what are you talking about? And
do a little politicking.
Right, right. He was like, no, it's that school. It's kind of close to Tuscaloosa, kind of close to Birmingham, but it's like a little art school, and, you know, like all the cute art boys are there, and they have this place called Barnstormers where all the bands play, and I think you would just have so much fun. And it's so weird that he was that intuitive suggestion So I went home to my parents to visit them, and they were living in Auburn, Alabama at the time. And I was like, I think I'm ready to go back to school. And they were like, okay, where do you want to go? You should go to Auburn. And I was like, no, I don't want to go to Auburn. You know, it's too big.
Uh-huh.
And Dad was like, well, let's go look at Alabama. And I was, my dad graduated from Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay. I was like, but I want to look at this school called Montevallo, too. And we just drove into the town. I didn't have any appointments to talk to anybody at the school or anything. We just drove. My dad and I drove to Montevallo. And I was like, yep, this is where I want to be. I don't care what it is. I want to be here. You know, like, mm-hmm. it just felt right.
Yeah.
And so I did the paperwork and enrolled. And a couple of months later, I was packed up and moving to Montevallo.
Yeah. So what about that experience? What was the major?
I was a piano pedagogy major.
That's it. That's right.
So so my aspiration was to teach music.
Mm-hmm.
And continue to play music.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's exactly what I did. And at the University of Montevallo, I met people that would become lifelong friends. I started two bands that would be long-term bands that released several albums. I feel like my whole life really started to take shape when I got to Montevallo.
Nice. And so just upon leaving Montevallo, would you end up in Birmingham?
Yeah. Why? So that was kind of a, I don't know what to do next, so I'm just going to move to Birmingham for a little while I figure it out.
Okay, so there was no draw to Birmingham? It was just kind of the closest thing?
Yeah, I was just like, I'd gone through a breakup in Montevallo, and I was like, I got to go somewhere fast.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go crash with my friends in Birmingham.
Okay.
And, you know, and this person and I are still great friends. It was Jim Fay, who I co-fronted Teen Getaway with. And,
okay.
He's probably one of my best friends, but I wasn't ready to move. I wasn't ready to break up the band. I just needed to clear my head. But then, you know, like, I'm like, but I could probably just move back to Georgia, or I could think about grad school. You know, there were a lot of like options on the table all of a sudden, but Birmingham just felt right, you know?
Huh.
And it wasn't like a decision via indecision, but it was a little bit like, why am I trying to rush away when I'm just discovering what Birmingham is?
Yeah.
And the music scene here at the time was just starting to really, I think, get its foothold.
During Bottle Tree?
This was before Bottle Tree.
Okay.
So this was, the main venues at the time were still the Nick, of course. But there was a Japanese restaurant in Five Points called Sakura.
Mm-hmm.
And they had started to do shows there, and it was really great. And all the people that worked at Sakura were in great bands. And there was a place called the Bomb Shelter, which is where Queens Park is now.
Okay.
And so that was another really great DIY venue. Hotel Birmingham, which was another really incredible DIY venue. And the scene here had just really started to build itself in a serious way.
Mm-hmm.
Cave 9, which was a really awesome all-ages venue, punk venue that I played a lot. So all those places are gone now, but they birthed Bottle Tree. And they birthed Firehouse, and they birthed what has anchored today's music scene.
Yeah. So, just to, first time I saw you live was with Will Stewart. Tell me a little bit about, how'd you meet Will?
So, I met Will here in this room at Ola Elegante. Les Newbie, I'd recorded several albums with him. With various projects, bands, and
so did Les meet you during the Montevallo days?
Actually, I do think that Les and I met back then. He was still playing in Verbena at that time, But we met briefly. We didn't become friends until much later, like after he'd moved to California and moved back.
Okay.
And he and my husband were good friends, like years and years ago too. But he had Will coming in to record this EP, and he had started to call on me for session gigs, you know, to sing and play keys. And so he called me, and I was just about to go on tour to Europe for the first time, and I was so stressed. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be gone for a month, you know, a 5.5 week tour, and I was like, you know, Les wanted me to come in. It was like 2 days before I was supposed to leave, or the day before I was supposed to leave. And I was like, oh God, I don't know this person. I don't know their music. I'm unprepared for this. Like, I was just really like, okay, but Les, this has to be fast. This is my fee. You got to tell Will that, you know. And like, looking back, I can't believe I now Will and I are such good friends and collaborators. I'm like, I can't believe he had to pay me to play on something. Because I came in and like the songs were just really lovely. It was very easy to pick up.
Was this Canley Seat?
This was an EP he released called Kusa.
Okay.
So this was I want to say this was all in 2012.
Okay.
So a good while back. And, you know, so I came in, I did it. Will was really nice. And then I left for Europe.
Yeah.
The EP came out. Will lived in Nashville. I lived here. And I thought the EP was really nice, you know. I was like, oh, that was really lovely, you know. And every once in a while, I'd go back to it and listen to it. And, you know, eventually, Will reached out to me one day from when he was still in Nashville. I was like, hey, do you want to, like, write some stuff together? Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, let's do it.
Right.
And so that's how Timber started.
Nice. And so just a little bit. Yeah, man.
Hello.
Hey, Chad.
Hey, Chad.
We're finishing up. You can sit in or whatever you want to do.
Hello.
Glad you're here, man.
Yeah, glad to be here.
So Timber, mm-hmm. How long has that been around now?
I think, let's see, is it 2020? So I think it's been about 5.5 years since we started working on that stuff.
Yeah, so that's cool, and that makes it easier to book too. Like,
yeah.
You might get Timber, you might get Will Stewart, you might get Janet Simpson.
When we've gone on the road, we just do all three.
Yeah,
you know, and especially like those gigs where you've got a 2-hour set, it's like, let's play everything we know and throw in some covers.
Right, everything but the kitchen sink.
That's right, exactly.
And then some. Well, cool. Let's just take a step back off into your album that's going to come out in March, right? First
that's
quarter
right.
of next year.
Hopefully in the first quarter of next year. So.
Social distance, right?
Safe distance.
Safe distance.
Safe distance. Yeah.
How timely.
I know. It's so bizarre. But there's just, it's the name of a song, and I decided that song needed to be the title track, but I made that decision in November of 2019.
Yeah.
So.
Whoopsie.
Yeah.
Well, great. Let's talk just a little bit about processes. And I know it's both and there's every song is unique in its own way, but do you find that melody first or guitar riffs, or is it just a line or a phrase that you get stuck in your head? And I know it's kind of a big question.
Yeah, usually the words come first. Usually it's a line or a phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always that comes with a melody attached to it, you know. So I'll hear, you know, I'm trying to think of some words that I recently strung together, but I'll hear like a sentence or a half a sentence, and it'll already have kind of an arc.
Yeah.
And then I'll say, well, what chords am I hearing under that? And so then I'll kind of figure out the progression, and once I have the progression in that first line, it just kind of all snowballs for me.
Yeah.
And becomes the song.
Okay, cool.
Gotcha. Tells me where I'm going.
Well, as far as things to come up, I would like to plug social media and ways to find your music. So we have Timber. You're very involved on Will's Records on
right.
top of your own. What are some ways to connect? I know Cornelius Chapel, but your personal social medias and the different medias there.
Yeah, so you can find me on Facebook at Janet Simpson. I have a music page there. And I'm not very interesting on Instagram, but the Simp Temp is my Instagram, so you can find me there. I'm pretty easy to find.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else to add or subtract?
No, it's been great to talk to you. Thanks so much for having me.
Janet, thank you so much.
All right. This song is called Black Turns Blue. You kept yourself secret from me and stayed safe in your quiet street. Yet every word from you is sweet. Grass in the June rain. I feel a strained uncertainty. See the shadows that fall on.
Say goodbye
to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.